The Reformation in England was primarily a battle for the Bible. William Tyndale famously said, "If God spares my life before many days, I will cause the boy who drives the plough to know more of the scriptures than you do." He said that to a Catholic priest. Bishop Stephen Bradley of the Church of England said, "We are in danger of forgetting truths for which previous generations gave their lives." There are so many truths of the Reformation, so many truths of the Bible that are being forgotten by people today. Previous generations of our believers, of our forefathers in the faith, died for these truths, which today are barely taught, known about, even in colleges and pulpits. Forget about even in the pews and youth groups. That our churches are in danger of forgetting the great Reformation truths for which previous generations of martyrs willingly laid down their lives was forcefully impressed upon me during a recent ministry trip to Europe. I had the opportunity to visit Oxford and to see the Martyrs' Memorial. It drew my attention to an event which occurred 450 years ago. On the 16th of October, 1555, just outside the walls of Balliol College, Oxford, which is where Wycliffe had once been professor, a stout stake had been driven into the ground with faggots of firewood piled high around its base. Two men were led out and fastened to the stake by a single chain bound around both their waists. The older man was Hugh Latimer, 80 years old, the Bishop of Worcester, one of the most powerful preachers of his day. The other man, Nicholas Ridley, 60 years old, was the Bishop of London, respected as one of the finest theologians in all of England. More wood was carried out and piled high around their feet. Then it was set alight. As the wood kindled and the flames began to rise, Bishop Latimer encouraged his younger companion, "Be of good cheer, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England, as I trust shall never be put out." Hundreds in the crowd wept openly as they watched the burning of these old, grey-haired bishops. The place of the execution is today marked by a small stone cross set in the ground in Broad Street. And nearby in St. Giles stands the imposing Martyrs' Memorial, erected 300 years later in the time of Queen Victoria, in memory of these two men, and of Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the first Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, who 4 months after their execution suffered the same torturous death by burning in the same place and for the same reason. Oxford is renowned as one of the greatest universities in the world. And you would think university a place of free thought, freedom of thought, freedom of investigation. And yet, this was a place of much torment for people who were Protestants during the Reformation. As I stood and considered the sacrifices and the sufferings of these courageous reformers in Oxford, crowds bustled by without stopping for even a moment to consider the historical significance of Latimer, Ridley, and Cranmer's martyrdom over 450 years ago. And it's not just the secular population who seem insensible to the significance of the Reformation in achieving levels of freedom, productivity, and prosperity unparalleled in history. Let's face it, the Reformation brought about the greatest freedoms, prosperity, and productivity ever seen in the history of the world. The Reformation unleashed energies that created the freest, most prosperous nations in history. And yet most do not even know that, let alone remember it. Visiting the various impressive cathedrals and churches in Oxford and London indicated that most churchgoers seem oblivious to the great issues that inspired the life-changing, culture-transforming faith for which these brave souls gave their lives. If you look in their entranceways, at their bulletin boards, their notice boards, their literature tables, the issues, the programs, the events being advertised on their calendars and displays, their notice boards and their literature tables in the vestibules, of these impressive architectural masterpieces speak more of the secularizing of the church than of any spiritual reformation or missionary zeal. It's a tragic thing to travel to some of these places, and it reminds us every generation needs revival, or the fire and fervor of our grandparents will become the formalism of their children and the apostasy of the grandchildren. There must be a fresh move of God's Spirit in every generation, that people will appreciate the great spiritual truths which make all the difference. On the 31st of October every year, many Christians seem more conscious of Halloween, a celebration of death, than of the Reformation. It appears that more of the children in our church are celebrating the pagan occultic Halloween than the great spiritual revival that led to the birth of the Protestant Reformation. On one day in 1519, seven men and women in Coventry were burned alive for teaching their children the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Apostles' Creed in English. And they burned these mothers and fathers to death for teaching their children the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, and the Apostles' Creed in their own language. Can you imagine? 1519. In his trial, Bishop Ridley, urged to reject the Protestant faith, responded, "As for the doctrine which I have taught, my conscience assures me that it is sound. And according to God's word, in a confirmation thereof, I seal the same with my blood." He says he's going to die willingly to prove that what he's taught is true. After much further pressure and torment, Bishop Ridley responded, "So long as the breath is in my body, I will never deny my Lord Christ and his known truth. May God's will be done in me." Bishop Latimer declared, "I thank God most heartily that he has prolonged my life to this end, that I may in this case glorify God by that kind of death." He was grateful for the privilege to die for Christ. It may surprise most English-speaking Christians that the first Bible printed in English was illegal, that the Bible translator was burned alive for the crime of translating God's word into English. William Tyndale is known as the father of the English Bible because he produced the first English translation from the original Greek and Hebrew scriptures. The first translation from the original languages and the first Bible to be printed as opposed to handwritten. 150 years before Tyndale, Professor John Wycliffe of Oxford University had overseen a handwritten translation of the Bible, but this had been translated from the Latin Vulgate. Itself a translation, of course, and obviously very flat, and therefore not communicating a lot of the dynamic essence of the original Greek and Hebrew. But Wycliffe's writings, an example, did inspire Jan Hus and Martin Luther. And Wycliffe was the father of the Reformation in England. He was the morning star of the Reformation. You know, the morning star is the star that shines the brightest at the darkest time of the night. It's pointing to the fact that the sun is going to rise. William Tyndale was a gifted scholar. He was a graduate of both Oxford and Cambridge universities. But it was at Cambridge that Tyndale was introduced to the writings of Luther and Ulrich Zwingli. We'll learn more about Zwingli next week as we look at the Reformation in Switzerland. William Tyndale earned his master's at Oxford and he was ordained into the ministry, but he never served as a priest, even though he was ordained as a priest. He served as a chaplain in a house and a tutor to a knight's children. He dedicated his life to the translation of the scriptures from the original Hebrew and Greek languages. Tyndale was shocked by the ignorance of the Bible prevalent amongst the clergy. To one ignorant cleric, he said, "I defy the Pope and all his laws. If God spares my life before many years pass, I will make it possible for the boy who drives the plow to know more of the scriptures than you do." He failed to obtain any ecclesiastical approval for his proposed translation. So Tyndale went into exile to Germany. As he described it, "Not only was there no room in my Lord of London's palace to translate the New Testament, but also there's no room to do it in all of England." He had tried through the Bishop of London, Tunstall, to get permission. He tried to do this under various auspices. Neither universities nor the church were willing to give him authority to translate the Bible. Supported by some London merchants, Tyndale sailed for Germany in 1524. He never returned to his homeland. He spent the rest of his life in exile. In Hamburg, in Germany, he worked on a New Testament which was ready for printing by the following year. Very hard, fast worker. Imagine doing a translation without computers, without typewriters, without all the different books you've got while you're on the run. It's not even that he's got this big library around. He's got to carry his books with him and he's got to keep moving to stay a few steps ahead of the Holy Roman Empire's soldiers. But as the pages began to roll off the printing press in Cologne, soldiers of the Holy Roman Empire raided the printing press, and Tyndale fled with as many of the pages as had been printed so far, literally with some fluttering out of his arms as he's running down the street. Only one incomplete copy of this Cologne New Testament edition survives, and it's worth a fortune. Tyndale then moved to Worms, where Martin Luther had made his strong stand before the emperor. And it was now a Protestant town, so he had freedom there to complete the New Testament, and it was published the following year, 1526. Of the 6,000 copies printed, only 2 copies of this edition survive. And they cost a fortune. I think one copy of a Tyndale New Testament first edition sold recently for £1.5 million. £1.5 million, it's a lot of money. Try and get any other book worth that. Why do so few survive? Because not only did the first printed edition of the English New Testament need to be produced in Germany, they had to be smuggled into England in bales of cotton from Antwerp. And there the bishops did everything they could to seek them out and to destroy them. And the Bishop of London, Cuthbert Tunstall, preached against the translation of the New Testament into English and had copies of Tyndale's New Testament ceremonially burned at St. Paul's. Can you imagine? They burned most of the copies in the first English New Testament. And poor William Tyndale had to start all over again. Almost all of his 6,000 New Testaments were destroyed by the Bishop of London. The Archbishop of Canterbury then began a campaign of buying up these contraband copies of the New Testament in order to burn them. But Tyndale had a good spirit. He said, the purchases of the Archbishop has helped provide the finances for a new improved edition. He'll do a better translation next time. In 1530, Tyndale's translation of the first 5 books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, the books of Moses, were printed in Antwerp, Holland. And Tyndale continued to work on further revisions and editions of the New Testament. And he also wrote books. He wrote The Parable of the Wicked Mammon and The Obedience of a Christian Man. Now this book, The Obedience of a Christian Man, was studied by Queen Anne, Anne Boleyn. And it even found its way to King Henry VIII, who was most impressed. "This book is for me and for all kings to read," he said. King Henry VIII sent out his agents to offer Tyndale a high position in his court, a safe return to England, and a great salary to oversee his communication. He thought, this is a great communicator. This man is fluent in so many languages. This is the man for me. I want him to be my chief of communications. But Tyndale was not willing to surrender his work as a Bible translator and a theologian and a preacher to merely become a propagandist for a king. He is serving the King of Kings. He's not going to lower himself to serving a mere king. In his book, The Practice of Prelates, Tyndale argued against divorce and specifically dared to assert that the king should remain faithful to his first wife, which the king was trying to ditch. Tyndale maintained that Christians always have the duty to obey civil authority except where loyalty to God is concerned. Then we must obey God rather than man. Henry VIII's initial enthusiasm for Tyndale now turned to rage. And so Tyndale became an outlaw not only to the Catholic Church and its Holy Roman Empire, but also to the English kingdom as well. He was an outlaw. Price on his head. Wanted, dead or alive. At the same time, Tyndale was carrying out a literary battle with Sir Thomas More, who was a Catholic chancellor at one time. He was Chancellor of England. Sir Thomas More gets a lot of good press. They've written a nice mount on him, and there's several films called a man for all seasons, which makes him out to be a wonderful hero. What they don't tell you is Sir Thomas More sent many, many Protestants to the stake and had them burned alive. He was a ruthless, cruel man, and he doesn't deserve the nice treatment that Hollywood's given him. But that's another story. Sir Thomas More attacked Tyndale in Dialogue Concerning Heresies in 1529. Tyndale responded with answer to More, and then More responded with confutation, and so on. So they had this kind of running battle of publishing books against one another's positions. But in 1535, Tyndale was betrayed by fellow Englishman Henry Phillips, who gained his confidence only to treacherously arrange for his arrest. Tyndale was taken to the state prison in the castle of Vilvoorde, near Brussels. And for 500 days, Tyndale suffered in a cold, dark, damp dungeon. And then, on the 6th of October, 1536, he was taken to a stake where he was garrotted and burned. His last reported words were, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." And then they strangled him. And they didn't do this out of kindness. They did this to shut him up. They started to realize so many of these Protestants are making the stake their pulpit, and they are winning so many people to Christ with their last words as their flames take over their bodies. So some of the most eloquent Protestants start to be carotid. They put a wire around their neck, and they would twist on the other side of the stake around it until it strangled them in order to shut them up, to stop them preaching. And his last words he could take out before they garrotted him was, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." This is a picture in Fox's Book of Martyrs of this event. There's a film out called God's Outlaw. Have any of you seen that film, God's Outlaw? Oh, good. We need to have that scene. It's one of the few very good films made of the reformers. Here's a Tyndale monument in Vilvoorde, Belgium. William Tyndale, who suffered martyrdom under Spanish rule on October the 6th, 1536, was strangled and burned at Vilvoorde. Amongst his last words were these, "Lord, open the eyes of the King of England," and this prayer was answered within a year by the issue under royal authority of the whole Bible in English. Tyndale's dying prayer was indeed answered in the most remarkable way. By this time, there was an Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, and a Vicar General, Thomas Cromwell, both of whom were committed to the Protestant cause. And there was a Protestant queen. Anne Boleyn had a copy of The Obedience of the Christian Man and a copy of Tyndale's New Testament hidden in the king's own bedroom. She was a secret Protestant and disciple of William Tyndale. And so God was moving in mysterious ways to bring victory for the Protestant cause to England. They collectively persuaded King Henry to approve the translation of the Coverdale translation. And by 1539, every parish church in England was required to have a copy of this English Bible available to all its parishioners. Miles Coverdale was a friend of Tyndale's, a fellow Cambridge graduate, and a reformer. His edition was the first complete translation of the Bible printed in English. It was mainly William Tyndale's work. It was supplemented with those portions of the Old Testament which Tyndale had not been able to translate before his death. Then a year after Tyndale's death, the Matthew's Bible appeared, and this was the work of another Bible translator and reformer, John Rogers. And because of the danger of producing Bible translations, he used the pen name Thomas Matthews, which was an inversion of William Tyndale, T-M-W-T, you see, inversion. In fact, at the end of the Old Testament, he had William Tyndale's initials W-T printed big and bold. At Archbishop Thomas Cranmer's request, King Henry VIII authorized that this Bible be further revised by Coverdale, and it was called the Great Bible. So he went from Tyndale's translation, the Matthew's Bible, Coverdale Bible, and this is all composed into the Great Bible. And that is the one that is read in the church as the famous Bible on a chain. The Bible on a chain was not chained so people couldn't read it, but that they could read it. It was in the vestibule of the church doors were open, anyone could come and read the Bible, and those who couldn't read would gather around and listen to it being read. And so you start to have lay readers within the church. And so in this way, Tyndale's dying prayer was spectacularly answered. The sudden, unprecedented countrywide access to the scriptures created widespread excitement. Just in the lifetime of William Shakespeare, 2 million Bibles were sold throughout the British Isles. And about 90% of Tyndale's wording passed on to King James Version of the Bible, which is the most widely circulated Bible of all time. In fact, this year we're celebrating 400 years of the King James Version, 1611 to 2011. In Britain, they're even printing a £2 coin with King James Bible, 1611, 2011 on it, with "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." And that, everybody in England is going to handle a £2 coin the next year. And that's one thing they're doing to remember it. British government's bringing out a I think it's 30 pence postage stamp, commemorating the King James Bible, having about 70 different events throughout England, including a complete reading of the Bible non-stop. There's events on BBC, Westminster Hall. On YouTube you can see the Prince of Wales and others reading parts of the Bible. Amazing things for a country that you would have thought has forgotten all their heritage. But this year there's a lot of festivities to remember the King James Bible, which is a remarkable translation. But it's 90% Tyndale's work. As King James had nothing to do with the translation except authorizing it, it should maybe be called the William Tyndale Bible rather than the King James Bible. And you can see some of the chronology of these Bibles, how they went from the Greek Old Testament translation, which was Septuagint, into the Latin Vulgate. And you can see through the years the different attempts at translation. And then Luther's translation, major one, all the way through Coverdale, Bez's, all the way to the present day. But Tyndale's work was absolutely pivotal. Not only can William Tyndale be described as the father of the English Bible, but in a real sense, he's the foremost influence on the shaping of the English language itself. Because Tyndale's translation was the very first from the original Hebrew and Greek into the English language, he had no previous translations to help in his choice of language. While Latin is noun-rich, Greek and Hebrew are verb-rich, they're very action-orientated. But at that time, the English language had been heavily influenced by French and Latin because they'd been dominated by Latin and French so much with invasions, and especially by the Catholic Church. Tyndale went back to the original Saxon and found that the Saxon English was more compatible with the Greek and the Hebrew than Latin and French. This clarity, the simplicity, the poetic beauty which Tyndale brought to the English language through his Bible translation served as a linguistic rallying point for the development of the English language. Much like Luther's translation of the Bible served for the German language, Tyndale's translation served for the English language. At the time of his translation, there were so many variations and dialects of English in so many sections of the country. The English language was being swamped with French words and Latin concepts. Tyndale's translation rescued English from these Latin trends and established English as an extension of the biblical Hebrew and Greek worldview, which is of great importance to us as we all speak English. And so every person in the world who writes in English, who speaks in English, who thinks in English, is to a large extent indebted to William Tyndale. That's why many call him the greatest Englishman. It is also extraordinary to think that while English was one of the minor languages of Europe in the early 16th century, only about 3 million people spoke English at that time. 3 million. Today, over 2 billion people worldwide communicate in English. Is that not absolutely extraordinary? Who could have imagined at that time? People have thought, well, maybe Spanish will be the world language. But nobody would have imagined English at that time. It's an amazing accomplishment from the small backwater of Europe. This very small, almost tribal language has grown to be the premier language in the world today.